ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Tom Linney.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to non-human animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also discuss how a vegan diet is the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, if you're concerned about your health, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Lisa Kimmerer, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Religions at Montana State University, Billings. That's coming up a little later on the show, but first some news.
From the Wall Street Journal, in 2009, Avery, a spotted mixed-breed dog, escaped from his Fort Worth home and was taken to a city animal shelter where workers promised to hold him until his owners picked him up. Instead, he was put to death. Avery's owners sued the shelter employee, who mistakenly ordered the killing, raising an emotionally charged issue argued earlier this month at the Texas Supreme Court. Can people be compensated for the sentimental value of a lost pet? Texas law awards damages for the market value of a lost pet, which is defined as the price the animal would fetch at sale. But it is an open question in Texas whether pet owners can also be compensated for their emotional losses. The issue has split courts in other states. Animal advocacy groups have rallied behind Jeremy and Catherine Medlin, Avery's owners, who contend the value of their 7-year-old dog was primarily sentimental and that the court should recognize that special bond that people form with their pets. But groups ranging from the American Veterinary Medical Association to the Cat Fanciers Association have filed briefs with the Texas Supreme Court saying that the costs of veterinary care, dog walking, and other pet services would soar if the court were to allow emotional damages in pet litigation. The Medlins haven't sought a particular amount of monetary damages, said their lawyer, Randall Turner. They considered Avery a member of their family. They brought this case to try to create a legal incentive for people to take good care of animals. A Fort Worth appellate court ruled for the Medlins in 2011, likening their claim to those involving damage to family heirlooms, which Texas courts have found can take into account the sentimental value of the items. The special value of man's best friend should be protected, the appellate court wrote, asking why such damages should be allowed for the loss of a sentimental photograph of a family and its dog, but not the dog itself. That was the argument Mr. Turner made to the Supreme Court on Thursday. We are just asking the court to treat dogs like it treats other property in this state, he said. But John Casey Jr., who represents the animal control worker sued by the Medlins, told the 9-member court that Texas law already provides sufficient compensation for lost pets, allowing owners to recover damages for such things as the cost of training a dog or its potential breeding value, along with other economic damages. Texas law, he added, doesn't even allow people to seek damages for emotional losses from the death of a friend or sibling. Given that, he said, there's no moral justification for allowing sentimental damages in pet cases. Opponents of allowing sentimental damages say there are other questions. My dog may be worth $1 million to me. Should that much money go to an owner for pain and suffering? Asked Elizabeth Coate, the general counsel of the Texas Veterinary Medical Association. Furthermore, she asks, should cats be valued more than dogs or hamsters or goldfish? I think it's funny how some of these groups that profit the most because of our strong emotional and sentimental attachments to our animals are the first to dismiss that bond when their negligence is involved.
Most chimpanzees used in scientific research paid for by the federal government will be retired if the recommendations of an independent advisory group are adopted. And future studies that would use chimps as lab subjects would have to be reviewed and approved by a newly formed oversight committee. An independent advisory group to the National Institutes of Health, known as the Council of Councils, voted 13-0 to accept recommendations from one of its working committees on the use of chimpanzees in NIH-funded research. The recommendations apply to up to 579 chimpanzees used in NIH-funded research. These include 115 chimps at the Texas Biomedical Research Institute in San Antonio and 167 at the Keeling Center for Comparative Medicine and Research in Bastrop, Texas. The recommendations stem from a 2011 review by the Institute of Medicine that concluded that while chimps have in the past been a useful tool in biomedical research, most current biomedical use of chimpanzees is unnecessary. The Institute of Medicine also concluded that where it's appropriate to use chimps, researchers should be governed by a set of strict guidelines. If the committee's proposal is approved by the National Institutes of Health, money would be cut from 6 of 9 biomedical research projects and 5 of 13 comparative behavioral studies. The committee determined that only 2 of 30 ongoing studies met all the Institute of Medicine requirements and should continue to be funded. According to Dr. Daniel Geschwind, a committee co-chairman, despite the potentially dramatic reduction in the taxpayer-funded chimpanzee research, the proposals shouldn't have a detrimental effect on biomedical studies. Dr. Geschwind of the University of California said, "In many cases, chimpanzees are no longer a necessary component of biomedical research." Stick around. Coming up next, we feature a conversation with Lisa Kimmerer, who's a philosopher activist who works against all forms of oppression on humans and other animals. She is Associate Professor of Philosophy and Religions at Montana State University, Billings, and the author of 6 books on animal issues. That's coming up next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas, Lisa Kimmerer. Thanks for being with us on the show, Lisa.
Thank you.
Lisa, can you tell our listeners a little bit about how you got involved in animal issues?
Well, when you're as ancient as I am, it's a long time ago. As a child, I was sensitive to animals, and I would say that my parents were sensitive to animals. And I also know that my sister helped me along by she gave me a flyer on down cows when I was in my early 20s, and that's when I went vegetarian. So I came to it from knowledge bit by bit and also something innate inside me.
You've written books on animal issues from a variety of perspectives, from women's issues to ethical concerns and religion.
I cover a lot of bases, and it's a bit much, actually. If I had a brain to go with my activism, I would actually focus on one subject and know it completely and thoroughly. But that's not how I operate. So, yeah, I deal with women's issues and religions and environment as well. And ethics, of course, is kind of the core of all of them, behind them all.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's usually said that there are 3 pillars of vegetarianism or veganism: the animal rights issue, the environmental reasons, and the health reasons, but there's an overlooked aspect, which is religious or spiritual reasons.
Yes, absolutely. And I actually say that there's 5 reasons: your health, the animals, people, and that has various categories under it, the uh-huh. environment, and religion. So for me, there are 5, and religion is absolutely overlooked. And to me, the frustrating thing about that is if we would educate ourselves as activists, I think it's one of the more likely channels through which to reach people, because people within religious traditions, they generally want to follow their religions. They're called to care, and they want to care. Whereas in dealing with any of the other topics, if a person simply says, well, I don't care about that, what do you say to that if they don't care? Whereas, for instance, in dealing with a Christian, no Christian's going to say to you, well, I really don't care about suffering, and there's nothing in my core teachings that say I have to. That's absolutely not true.
Yeah, and it seems like it's so much easier for someone to dismiss the idea of vegetarianism or veganism based on their faith. So if their, if their priest or their pastor or whoever it might be says, is following the traditional teachings, you know, encouraging a meat-based diet, then I think it's so much easier for them to say, oh, well, you know, my faith allows me to, you know, says to do this, or, you know, this is how it was in the Bible. But
to me, that's the fascinating thing, is that people in the movement believe this. They believe exactly what you're saying, that people who are religious are simply going to say, my Bible says I can do it, and my tradition says I can do it, and so I'm going to keep right on doing it. But that's ignorant. Their tradition doesn't say that they can do it. Now, it's true that most people in their church and most of their religious leaders are saying that they can do it, but that's no excuse. If you truly believe in your religion, you have to go back to the sacred texts, and you have to go to the religious exemplars. You have to go to the ideals. And when you go to all of those, none of those point to eating animal products this day and age.
It's so easy to find some excuse to rationalize meat eating in any of the traditions. Jesus ate fish. I've even heard Jesus was a fisherman, but I think that's wrong. And Buddha said you can eat any animals as long as they aren't killed specifically for you, et cetera, et cetera. There's always some excuse that people can find.
Yeah, you know, and those, again, they're misconceptions. The only time that Jesus ate, that we know, that the documents say that Jesus ate any fish, is when he's risen from the dead. Now, if you're risen from the dead, you're already in a situation so radically different, and he put one little bite in his mouth. And again, the other thing I would say is, who cares? Let's say that let's say Jesus did eat fish occasionally, or let's even say Jesus was a fisherman. This day and age, the situation is so completely different that you can't look back to what Jesus did.
Right.
Today, we have undermined our oceans. The fisheries are collapsing. The problems that animal agriculture is causing, the suffering that is behind it, they're unconscionable if you're a serious Christian who believes in compassion and caring and believes that this earth is created by a divine, that this is a divine creation, and that we are responsible for it.
And it's also sort of ironic that a fish is the symbol of Christianity.
Yes, that's true. Vegans
have sort of adopted the word ahimsa as one of their main components of their faith. So let's go back to where ahimsa comes from and explain that to our listeners, if you would.
Ahimsa is core to the Hindu tradition. And the Hindu tradition, of course, is core to all the Eastern faiths. Buddhism sprang from it. And without Hinduism, you would not have the Jain tradition or the Buddhist tradition, certainly not as we know them. They are so indebted to Hinduism. You know, they obviously grew and developed afterwards, but they are completely based on Hindu teaching. So ahimsa is the core, one of the core teachings. So ahimsa is not to harm. So the basic religious foundation of the Hindu tradition is that we don't harm. And what's great about this teaching is its links to other Eastern ideas like karma and reincarnation. So karma means action, and your future is determined by your actions. So your reincarnation is based on your actions in this life. So the links between those three ideas, ahimsa, reincarnation, and karma, are strong, and they are linked to, I'd say, a fourth and a fifth idea, this idea of oneness that comes out of the East.
Mm-hmm.
That there's this shared subtle essence, this Brahman, this inner being that is sacred, so that all beings are in yourself, yourself is in all beings, and the divine is in both. So oneness obviously is linked to this idea of ahimsa and reincarnation, because once you've been born again and again throughout eternity, your soul, or Atman in their tradition, there's a certain oneness of being, that everything that exists was at some time your brother and your sister and your mother and your father and your beloved friend in another lifetime. So how you interact with other beings ought to be changed by this.
What I find fascinating is this idea of oneness seems to be found in all religions, not just the Eastern ones. Like when Jesus said, if you do it to the least of these, my brethren, you do it to me. And the idea of the golden rule, that if you hurt others, you're only hurting yourself.
Yes. And that's, again, that's why I love to look at religious traditions. They have this underlying core of goodness that speaks to not just animal welfare, but animal liberation, that we cannot do the things that we're doing to animals and stand firmly within our religious tradition. They're about compassion.
And do you find that most people extend this, in the Hindu faith, extend this oneness to the concept or to animals themselves, or do people stop at a particular class or being or species?
It's a very good question. In my time, when I went to India, I was young. I started traveling kind of instead of college, what I wanted to learn initially I knew I needed to travel to learn it. And these religions, these Eastern religions, were one of the things that I wanted to know more about. And their tendency to compassion was one of the things that fascinated me with Eastern religions. And being over there, there's no question that they have a different approach to animals. Now, one of the things I always say is that when I write about religions, I'm not talking about what people do. I'm talking about what their religion teaches. So I think we have to make that distinction because people so often fall short of their religion. That said, I would definitely say that in India, it's much easier. Whether or not someone is honoring ahimsa, no one will deny it. They are absolutely clear that this is part of their faith. Whereas here, people will tend to say what you said, oh, my religion says I can be cruel. I mean, they're not going to say it quite that way, but it's more or less what they're saying when they're saying that they can eat other animals.
Yeah, that God put animals here for us to eat. I always hate to hear that.
But notice how that changes it when you say honestly what you're doing. My religion says I can be cruel. No one's going to say that.
Well, maybe the Satanist.
Well, you know, I don't know enough about them to say anything about it, so I'll leave that at that.
Well, that can be your next book.
So you've asked about the Hindu tradition, and we've looked a little at ahimsa and the various things that are connected with that. And there's one I didn't mention, and that's interpenetrability, which I trip over. But basically what that word means is the interconnections between, well, really the way to look at it is that there isn't this distinction between a human being and everything else that's out there. It's kind of a subcategory of oneness. But it's a little different because in the Hindu traditions, the gods can become animals. They can take any form they want. And some of the gods, like Vishnu, are famous for taking different forms of different animals. So, for example, in his fish incarnation, he sees this devoted Hindu doing the morning cleanings, and he knows this person is very compassionate. So he shows up in the form of a fish. And sure enough, the person sees the fish and is concerned about the fish. And the fish says, you know, save me, help me. So he puts him in a little container where he thinks the fish will be safe. And then pretty soon, of course, the fish grows and says, save me, help me, into a bigger container and a bigger container. Finally, putting this fish into the tub and then a pond and then the river and finally into the ocean. And at this point, the guy figures out, you know, this is no ordinary fish. So sure enough, he figures out that the fish is Vishnu, and Vishnu says, a great flood is coming. You need to build a boat. You need to, you know, these dimensions, it's very much like the flood myths around the world, the particulars of how it unfolds. But one of the wonderful differences is that the fish then saves humanity. The fish then says, you know, follow these directions, and I will pull you to safety. So then the person puts the rope around the fish's horn, and the fish pulls the boat, out into safety, into the waters. And so their flood myth is based on one of their gods coming down as a fish and saving humanity. So that's interpenetrability, where there's no distinction between the gods and the animals. Or another example is Ganesha, the elephant-headed god.
Yeah,
so, you know, you can have an elephant, and it's not like it's weird in their tradition. Like, wow, that's really weird. This human has an elephant's head. How is that even possible? And their myth explains it. It's a beautiful myth. So it's Ganesha is the son of Shiva and Parvati, the great god Shiva and his consort Parvati, and she wants babies. You know, she's a motherly type. And he says, "Look, I'm an ascetic. I really can't be bothered with kids." And she says, "Oh, come on, you're my husband. It's your responsibility." And he says, "Oh, you know, here." He rips a piece of her sari off and says, "Cuddle this." So, you know, she's a very powerful goddess. So she's cuddling this piece of cloth, and pretty soon it starts to kick and move, and it comes to life. And she's so excited because she has her baby. But Shiva, of course, is not excited. He did not want kids. So he glares at the kid. He looks at the kid with his third eye, which is very powerful, and off falls the head. So, you know, she's angry. What? You didn't want kids. You gave me this cloth. I've got kids by my own power, and then you knock the kid's head off. You are useless. You are the worst husband on the planet. He's disgraced. So he creeps out into the world. He knows he's got to find another head, and the first thing he comes upon is an elephant. And now remember ahimsa. So he takes the elephant's head, but he throws the elephant into the ocean, so the elephant comes back to life. And this is no ordinary elephant. This is the elephant of Indra. It's also a very powerful elephant. And he brings the head back, and he plops it on his kid. And again, there's no dialogue about, oh, my God, you've brought an elephant's head for our fun. No, she's quite happy, and the kid then comes back to life with the head, and all is well. And again, in their tradition, this complete comfort. with a human being with an elephant's head and that lack of distinction between humans and the rest of the animal kingdom.
Well, I think it's, I mean, it's a really neat concept. And, you know, I think there was a movement or at least a idea that was growing in the U.S., for instance, where, you know, people were encouraged to look at every other person and see Jesus or God in them. So if you saw a homeless person on the street and think, okay, well, what if this person was Jesus? What kind of, you know, care would you provide to this person? How would you treat this person differently?
Yes.
You know, we don't really have that per se when it comes to animals. And I think that would really do a lot for the movement if people could really see God or maybe even just God's creation and see God's work in the animals themselves. Maybe that can lead to some, you know, reform for the treatment of animals.
Absolutely. And as I say, this is one of the characteristics that the Western traditions don't seem to have is this interpenetrability. And I think it's a beautiful concept and one that we can learn much from. But on the other hand, I would say that our idea of service, the Western idea of service, as you bring up, and you know, the least of these, if you've done it unto me, one of my favorite quotes, this idea that we are called to serve and to give, to be humble, to share. I mean, we have teachings that are just as powerful and just as beautiful. Okay, we haven't got the color. We haven't got the elephant-headed God. You know, we don't have as many colorful animals in our tradition. But our moral teachings are just as powerful.
Many people know that Gandhi was vegetarian, and it seems to me that he brought ahimsa back into the modern era. How much of an influence did Gandhi have on India? As I understand it, people are eating more and more meat in India.
Yes. He was tremendously influential in his day. You know, I'm glad you bring up the Indian diet, because I think it's important for those of us here to know that India has traditionally been, and for centuries, been a largely, I would say, vegan community. Now, the exception is dairy products, but uh-huh. I don't want to say vegetarian, and of course there's a word for it. I don't know what it is, but when you eat eggs...
Ovo-lactone.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I've said it wrong. You don't eat eggs or flesh, but you'll eat dairy products.
Lacto-vegetarianism.
Thank you. All right, so that is largely what India's been. And the reason I think this is important is sometimes you have people arguing completely unsubstantiated things like the blood type argument. Now, if the blood type argument were true, there would be people in India who would be in, you know, they simply couldn't function. They couldn't make it. And that's obviously not the case. And it has not been for centuries.
What's the blood type argument?
The blood type argument is there are certain types of blood and you have to eat flesh. You haven't heard that argument?
No, I haven't.
Oh, yeah,
it is particularly annoying.
Yes.
Yeah, it
is.
It is so ridiculous. It has that pseudoscience sound, you know, blood type. But it is completely not based on anything scientific.
I was going to say, I'd have to go tell Red Cross that I changed, my blood is apparently changed before I donate again.
Yes.
And I also saw one of your books is Sister Species and Feminism and, you know, Animal Rights and vegetarianism definitely have a link, and something I haven't really studied a lot about, but I did see Carol Adams, the author of The Sexual Politics of Meat, speak a few
Wonderful.
Months ago, and I mean, it really did hit home,
yes.
you know, these sort of hierarchies of power, and,
yes.
you know, how is it that these hierarchies of power play into the way animals are treated, you know, on this planet?
I would say it's foundational. I would say it undergirds the whole rotten arrangement. I'd say that once you have a system where there's a hierarchy, where person A is above person B, you have set the system in which everybody wants to be above someone or something else, whether it's nature or a cow or a chicken, and that you have lost that sense of oneness, that sense of reverence for life and for the natural world, and you suddenly have a system in which certain things overpower and exploit other things because they have a right to do so.
It seems to me that once you recognize the oppression of one system, like, you know, the feminist movement or slavery, it seems like you would be able to apply that to animal oppression as well.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, it has been a frustration for me for many years that when I first went to the East Coast and first bumped into racism, I grew up completely ignorant in a very lily white Protestant valley, farming valley. And when I first bumped into it, I was so surprised by the hostility, not only towards myself as a Caucasian, but also towards the whole idea of liberating animals. And I understand that when you've been oppressed and someone is concerned about something you consider lesser than yourself, it's annoying. How can you be concerned about a mouse? And this was when I was in graduate school. And they were trapping mice. And I was actively springing the traps and trying to do something to prevent what was going on and bring some kind of a better system and change. And this was very upsetting to some of the minorities who had been mistreated all their lives based on skin color by a certain segment of the population and simply couldn't see why I should be worried about a mouse when their problems were so pressing and had been for so long. As a white person, it's not something I can comment on. I haven't walked in their shoes. What I can say is, as a female, the fact that I have experienced a whole lot of prejudice against women has certainly never prevented me from caring about others who are oppressed more. In fact, I would say that as a female, I'm far less concerned about myself as a female in relation to how animals are treated. That said, knowing that they're all connected, fighting one is fighting the other.
I often see the argument that veganism is a concern for the elitist, white, lazy, rich people that can afford, you know, to have a hobby like veganism. And that is a sort of an upsetting argument as well.
Well, you could as well argue that those who are fighting against racism are the elite. They're not the ones, you know, slogging through life just trying to find something to eat. That's why they have time to fight against racism. That's a ridiculous argument.
Yeah.
It's an insult. When something's wrong, you try to change it. You find ways, and it isn't indicative of the fact that you have all sorts of leisure when you're... Anyone who argues that is basically saying and showing that they don't take seriously the suffering of animals.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think with most people, you know, recognizing oppression and sort of seeing the David versus Goliath or trying to pick the underdog in these situations, you would be able to identify the underdog in various elements of life, whether it's women or minorities or animals. And so I that is definitely frustrating, I think, for most of us in the movement and also being criticized, for caring about animals and for people making you think that that's the only thing that you can care about at one time.
Yes, and you know, this pulls us right back to religions. The idea that somehow our love and our caring is limited. Mm-hmm. One of the whole ideas of Christianity is that love is limitless.
Right.
And that our service should be limited, whether it's women or gays or Hispanics. It doesn't matter. The point is, if someone is suffering, if someone is mistreated, you go to them and you help them and you do what you can to bring change. That's the model that Jesus set, and he is the moral exemplar of the tradition.
We've been talking with Lisa Kemmerer, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Religions at Montana State University at Billings and author of a number of books on animal issues. Lisa, we appreciate you spending the time with us on the show today.
Thank you.
To learn more, if you give us your website.
LisaKemmerer.com. And I encourage you not just to look at sister species if you're interested in women's issues, but also Speaking Up for Animals, which focuses specifically on those.
We'd love to have you back on the show to discuss some other topics.
Terrific. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Be sure to visit Lisa's website at lisakemmerer.com. That's KEMMERER.com.
If you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the Listen button.
And if you'd like to learn more about a plant-based diet, please visit the Vegetarian Society of El Paso's website at vsep.org. Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
And I'm Tom Linney. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.